The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Claire Catford with Guardian Daily on Wednesday, July the 16th. On the way today, Israel backs Hezbollah swap deal, the bodies of two Israeli soldiers for five Lebanese prisoners. Also today, which British cities are economic winners and which are losers?
Reading, Swindon, Milton Keynes, they're doing really well. But also Manchester and Leeds have shot up the table. At the other end, you've got real losers. Cities like Hastings has actually got worse.
And a bucket and spade break for Gordon Brown. What does Southwold in Suffolk have to offer the PM and his family?
A nice tucked away little holiday cottage, and him and Sarah and his small children can enjoy a sort of quiet traditional time.
But first, let's hear the headlines and have a look at today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
In a significant shift in foreign policy, the United States will send a top diplomat for talks with Iran. The envoy will join colleagues from other world powers at a meeting with Tehran's chief nuclear negotiator. US Undersecretary of State William Burns will meet Saeed Jalili in Geneva on Saturday. They'll discuss Iran's response to an offer made last month to give up sensitive nuclear work the West believes is aimed at building an atomic bomb. Tehran and Washington cut diplomatic ties shortly after the Iranian Revolution of 1979. Witnesses say five Lebanese prisoners have been taken from an Israeli prison and driven towards the Lebanese border. It's ahead of an expected trade for two Israeli soldiers captured by Lebanese guerrillas 2 years ago. The day promises to be fraught with tension in Israel, where the servicemen are presumed to be dead. In Lebanon, one of those due to be exchanged, Samir Kantar, is expected to receive a hero's welcome. He's a militant convicted over one of the most brutal attacks in Israel's history. We'll be getting the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem in just a moment. The biggest bout of industrial unrest for years will break out across parts of Britain today. Tens of thousands of council workers and civil servants are striking in a bitter dispute over pay. The walkout by members of three unions will close schools, libraries, museums and civic offices across England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Rubbish collections will also be cancelled. Tory leader David Cameron says the discrimination and economic disadvantage experienced by black people must change. In a wide-ranging interview with The Guardian, he's praised Barack Obama's warning that too many black fathers have abandoned their responsibilities for their children. Mr. Cameron says many black church leaders have expressed the same concerns to him, and it's time for a responsibility revolution to change patterns of behaviour. Manchester City have missed out on the big summer signing of Ronaldinho. They've been edged out by AC Milan in the battle for the Barcelona star, despite tabling a much higher bid. The price tag on the former World Player of the Year, £16.7 million. In this morning's papers, The Telegraph informs us we have the right to shoot dead a burglar. It says homeowners acting in self-defence have been given the legal right for the first time to fight back against burglars and muggers. The Pope rides to Rowan's rescue is the headline in The Independent, saying Pope Benedict has launched an unprecedented drive to prevent the fragmentation of the Anglican Communion. It's ahead of the once-a-decade gathering of 800 bishops, which begins today. The Times claims Britain's third-largest airline, BMI, will fly near empty aircraft from this autumn in order to preserve multi-million pound takeoff and landing slots. The Express fears riots in Britain, saying an influential group of MPs has warned immigration is the single biggest cause of public concern, and that could lead to violence. A weather warning from the Mail, it may rain until September, and The Star claims Gary Lineker has signed up as a football pundit for a new show in the Netherlands. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The Israeli cabinet has given its final approval for a prisoner exchange with the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Under a deal mediated by the UN, Israel will release five Lebanese prisoners and Hezbollah will free the bodies of two Israeli soldiers seized in a cross-border raid in 2006. Their capture triggered the 33-day war between Israel and Hezbollah in the same year. Guardian Daily's Andy Duckworth has been speaking to The Guardian's Middle East correspondent Rory McCarthy.
We're in the final stages of the prisoner swap this morning. Overnight, the Israeli authorities moved the five Lebanese prisoners who were due to be released. They were taken from jail and delivered to a military facility close to the border of Israel and Lebanon, close to a crossing point called Rosh HaNikra, which is where the prisoner swap will happen this morning. There has been television footage that's shown the Lebanese prisoners being processed by the Israeli authorities. The prisoners are, you know, dressed in grey tracksuits, still wearing handcuffs and shackles on their ankles. On the Lebanese side, Hezbollah has brought a convoy down to the border, which we believe is carrying the remains of the two Israeli soldiers who were captured 2 years ago. Shortly they are to be handed over. When their bodies have been properly identified, and that's a process that might take some time, when that's happened, the Israelis will then hand over the five Lebanese prisoners, and sometime later they will hand over the bodies of 199 Lebanese and Palestinian fighters who have died in conflict in the Middle East over the past several years.
Now, the capture of those two soldiers sparks a 34-day war back in 2006. Why have Hezbollah agreed to return them now?
Well, a lot has happened since then. It was almost exactly 2 years ago. The two soldiers, Ehud Goldwasser and Eldad Regev, were in a military patrol driving along the border between Israel and Lebanon. At that moment, Hezbollah launched an attack. They fired some rockets into Israel, and then they ambushed the patrol. They killed three of the soldiers and dragged these two Israeli soldiers across the border and have been holding them ever since. There was, as you say, this 34-day war, which claimed the lives of around 1,200 people. And since then, shortly after the war, it became increasingly clear to the Israelis that the two soldiers were dead. And there began a long process of negotiations to try and get their bodies back. And that has taken nearly 2 years. It's moved quite slowly. But in the last few months, the process has accelerated until we've reached the moment of the prisoner swap today.
And what do we know about the men that Israel have released?
They're going to release five Lebanese prisoners who they've been holding in jail for a long time. Foremost among them, and really the headline figure today, is a Lebanese man called Samir Kuntar. He was involved in a pretty horrific attack in 1979 when he was just 16 years old. He was part of a small group of militants who sailed from Lebanon into northern Israel on a rubber dinghy. They landed on the shore at an Israeli town called Nahariya. And there they attacked an apartment block, broke into a house of the Haran family, and killed the father and daughter. And during the attack, the mother was hiding in the bedroom with her second daughter, and as she was trying to stop her daughter crying, she accidentally smothered her to death. So Samir Kuntar was arrested, convicted of murder and attempted murder, and has been in jail in Israel ever since. He's the Lebanese prisoner who spent longest in an Israeli jail, and he's really a very high-profile figure. It's a big deal for Israel to release him, and there's no doubt that when he is released today, Hezbollah are going to make enormous political capital out of his release. They'll regard it as a big symbolic victory, and you know they'll be parading him through the streets of Beirut today.
And there's more on that at guardian.co.uk/Israel. Also on The Guardian's website today, an interview with Tory leader David Cameron. Find that at guardian.co.uk/politics. Eating nuts in pregnancy could double your child's risk of asthma. That's at guardian.co.uk/science. And at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree, Jonathan Glancy on why steam power deserves a revival. Forget the North-South divide. Geographical location is no longer a mark of economic success. A new report from the Work Foundation reveals that cities like Reading, Bristol, Manchester and Newcastle made big gains in economic growth, whereas Hastings, Stoke, Barnsley and Wigan are falling behind. It says that some cities have been able to bounce back after the decline of manufacturing, whereas others have not been able to attract higher value business, which in turn provide skilled jobs. I asked Alexandra Jones, the Associate Director of the Work Foundation, for more detail on who were the winners and who were the losers.
I think some of the winners are the cities that have always done well. Cambridge and Oxford remain at number one and number two in 2005 as they did in 1995. But you've got some real winners over the last 10 years, cities like Reading, Swindon, Milton Keynes. They're doing really well, many of them in the southeast. But also Manchester and Leeds have shot up the table. They've really improved their economies. So those are our winners. At the other end, you've got real losers. Cities like Hastings has actually got worse over the last 10 years. Cities like Stoke are facing real challenges. And what you've got is a real divide between the resurgent cities, the ones that have got much better over the last 10 years, and what we're calling the stuck cities, the ones that have not only not got better, but they actually seem to be sliding down the scale.
To what extent have these successful cities managed to reinvent themselves and attract inward investment, and those that are not doing so well just haven't managed that?
I think it's a combination. Cities like Manchester and Leeds really have been working hard to reinvent themselves. Their city centres are unrecognisable from 10 years ago. Manchester's attracted the Bank of New York. Leeds is the second biggest financial centre in England outside London. So they've been working very hard to attract investment, but they're also big cities. They're at the heart of the north. They've done well from the transport connections. And I think cities like Hastings and Stoke have struggled partly with attracting investment, but also partly with location. Actually, the transport links for Hastings, they're poor. For Stoke, they're almost too good. It's almost too easy to go through the city. And both have been hit by changes in industry, particularly Stoke and ceramics.
How likely is there to be a shift in people moving to these more prosperous areas and then leaving the ones that are the losers without any workforce at all, or a workforce that's not appropriately skilled?
Well, I think there's two things. There are some cities that have people still living in them, but commuting to nearby resurgent cities. So if you look at Manchester, it's actually working with ten local authorities, nine other local authorities, because it knows that many of its highly skilled workers don't live in Manchester. They live nearby. So people may stay in the areas, but commute. There are other cities, though, that are facing real challenges about some of the highly skilled workers leaving, and some of those people less able to leave are staying there, and the availability of high-skilled jobs is very low, so they tend to be stuck in poorer paying jobs. So there are some cities, the ones we've been calling stuck, like Hastings, which face real challenges about attracting back the highly skilled workers. Even if they don't work there, they could well commute into cities like London, and at the moment that doesn't seem to be happening so much.
Where does that leave us as a country? Do we need to see greater government intervention in those areas that need more support?
I think there's two things. There's one, investment in the cities that are doing well, because actually they could do better. Some of the transport links, some of the housing, some of the skills challenges are all still there. We could well do better from our Manchesters and our Leeds and our Bristols than we are at the moment. But there's also something about linking those stuck cities better to the way the economy is changing. If bigger cities like Bristol, Manchester, Leeds are doing well, actually making sure that we link our slightly stuck cities to those bigger cities, that we make sure we link regeneration with how the economy is changing. Those are the ways that you could really make a difference. So regeneration doesn't happen in isolation from all the work that's going on to attract investment, to get more jobs, and to get more highly skilled people in an area.
So to what extent, too, is it now inaccurate to describe Britain or the UK as having a north-south divide?
It doesn't really capture it. It's actually a divide between successful cities. Manchester and Leeds are doing very well. Newcastle, Sheffield, even Liverpool has really improved over the last few years. And you've still got cities like Hastings and Plymouth really struggling. So I think a more accurate way to describe it is about successful cities and stuck cities. And then you start getting into understanding that actually different cities start from very different places. The economy is affecting them differently. And we need different policies for the people who live and work there.
Alexandra Jones from the Work Foundation on the changing economic shape of Britain. The wife of canoeist John Darwin continued to lie to her family even after her supposedly dead husband reappeared, a court in Teesside has heard. And Darwin pretended to be overcome with emotion after being told that her husband was still alive. She denies five counts of obtaining money by deception and one of obtaining property by deception. Her husband, John Darwin, has admitted deception and will be sentenced later. The court also heard how the Darwin sons, Mark and Anthony, had no idea about their parents' deception. They were giving evidence for the prosecution. The Guardian's Helen Carter was in court.
Essentially, we're talking about their betrayal at the hands of their parents after learning that their father had faked his own death in the canoe accident. So the eldest son, Mark, spoke of how when he learned that his father had died in this so-called tragic accident, that it crushed his world. And as he said those words in the witness box today, his mother dropped her head and she wept and repeatedly dabbed her nose with a white handkerchief, because obviously it was very emotional for her, because she's been estranged from her children ever since the details of this case broke last December.
The jury is also told that one of the sons was going to propose to his fiancée during a holiday to Canada when his father disappeared.
That's right. The younger son, Anthony, was on a holiday to Canada. He was due to go to the Niagara Falls, where presumably he was going to propose to his girlfriend, Louise. But they were only 2 or 3 days into the holiday when they learned about his father disappearing in a canoe. And he immediately came back to the UK and travelled up to his mother's house.
Anne denies, that's the mother, denies 6 counts of fraud and 9 counts of money laundering. However, her husband has admitted deception and will be sentenced.
Yeah, she's using an unusual defence of marital coercion, which means that she was acting against her will. She was so overwhelmed by John Darwin. But the prosecution say that she was actually no shrinking violet and that she was actually a driving force. And in their words, in the prosecutor's words, they said that she kept up this betrayal for 5.5 years, that she was a determined, resolute woman who was able to lie and deceive literally at length. So far from being a victim of marital coercion, according to the prosecution, she was, a key part in this £250,000 alleged fraud.
And one of the bizarre twists in all of this is that John Darwin has, of course, walked into a police station 5 years after being presumed dead when his canoe was found in the sea close to his home.
That's right. He walked into a police station in the West End of London on the 1st of December last year and announced that he was suffering from amnesia. Unfortunately, a photograph later emerged from July 2006 showing him and his wife happily smiling with an estate agent in Panama in Central America, which blew away that kind of suggestion that he was suffering from amnesia and didn't know where he was for the last 5.5 years.
I'm Claire Catford, still to come on Guardian Daily, nudging us all in the right direction, a new book that says the law is not always the way to prompt us to make good moral choices. And we hear from Kate Summerscale, the winner of the Samuel Turner Prize for Nonfiction.
I feel completely dazed and amazed, and I haven't taken it in yet, but no, it's incredible.
But first, how to influence people and win votes. It depends on the way you do it, according to a new book. Called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Wealth and Happiness, author Richard H. Thaler describes what he calls a third way, a libertarian paternalism. His ideas allegedly have already been picked up by David Cameron and Barack Obama. Guardian Daily's John Dennis went to meet him at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business in the City of London. First of all, he asked him, what is a nudge?
A nudge is a small feature of the environment that attracts our attention and in so doing influences our choices.
And we need a nudge because we don't behave rationally. Why don't we behave rationally?
Well, we try to behave rationally, but we are human. And part of being human means that we're busy, that we're pretty smart as animals go, but our brains are pretty slow compared to computers. We're absent-minded. We are subject to temptation. So we have lots of good intentions and we try hard, but oftentimes the world is just a bit too tough for us.
How might politicians or policymakers get us to behave more rationally?
Well, I was spending a couple of weeks in London. I've always been a great admirer of the little signs on the sidewalk telling us which way to look. We dumb Americans desperately need them. Now, it's not that we're dumber than you Brits, although you do sound more intelligent than we do. But, of course, it's just that all our instincts are wrong. And so the government smartly decided that they could save several hundred pedestrians a year by putting reminders that the traffic comes from the opposite direction. Oftentimes, the nudges that we propose are as simple as that, just giving people a hint about what the right way to look is.
You've characterized your ideas in Nudge as being libertarian paternalism. Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
Well, it is a bit, but not the way we define it. So by paternalism, all we really mean is trying to help people, and trying to help people as judged by themselves. So if a tourist comes up to you and asks you the directions toward Parliament and you tend to point them in the correct direction, then you're a paternalist by our definition. By libertarian, or as it would be called over here, liberal, all we mean really is retaining people's right to choose. So we advocate picking default options properly and automatically enrolling people into savings plans, as is going to be done here in the UK quite soon. But people have the option of opting out. I think it is possible to devise a policy that is good for people as they define it and retains all of their freedom to choose. And that's what we mean by libertarian paternalism.
But in Britain, we had for many years warnings on cigarette packets, increasingly sort of loud about how dangerous it was to carry on smoking, how harmful it was to their health. But then a year ago, smoking was outlawed in public places, and it was the law, the legislation, that had the dramatic effect on people's behaviour, not the nudge.
Well, I think there can be a limit to how far we can go with nudging. The purpose of writing the book was to really just show how much we can do using this very small tool, a gentle nudge. Now, you know, I don't suggest that we can fight organized crime or terrorism with nudges. Osama bin Laden probably can't be nudged.
Your ideas in Nudge and elsewhere have been enthusiastically taken up by David Cameron and the Conservative Party here in Britain, but also by Barack Obama and the Democrats over in America. That's quite odd, isn't it? We've got the sort of the left-wing party in America, but the right-wing party here getting excited about what you've been saying.
We propose this as a real third way, a set of ideas that are neither left nor right. And the fact that some of Obama's advisors and some of Cameron's advisors are finding our ideas appealing, that makes us very happy.
Richard Thaler, whose book Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth and Happiness, is published by Yale University Press.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
So, you've decided to stay in the UK for your break this summer. Well, you're not alone. Alongside thousands of Brits, Gordon Brown is reportedly planning to take his family on a bucket and spade summer holiday, a break from Tony Blair's more lavish family foreign trips. Downing Street has refused to confirm or deny reports that the Prime Minister plans to spend time at Southwold in Suffolk. The Guardian's Patrick Barkham has been to see what the resort has to offer.
Well, I mean, Southwold really is the quintessential English seaside resort. And as everyone is saying, it's that classic sort of bucket and spade destination with lots of families playing on the nice golden sands and pensioners reclining by their beach huts on the beach. But of course, it is also incredibly well heeled too. And it's had a real reputation in recent years for spiraling property prices. You know, beach huts change hands for upwards of £50,000 and tiny fishermen's cottages fetch nearly £500,000. So it's a kind of, it's only for the affluent, really. And as several old timers here told me, Southwold's always been a little bit posh. You know, it definitely isn't a Blackpool or a Great Yarmouth.
So no amusement arcades and kiss me quick hats, which is what I've been used to.
There's a very traditional Punch and Judy show. You know, and of course there is a pier, and you can get plenty of candy floss and fish and chips. But no, there isn't. There aren't like mass ranks of arcades and that kind of thing. There's delis and fancy clothing shops and gastro pubs. It's much more that kind of place.
And what do local people think about the PM descending upon them?
Well, poor old Gordon, he can't really win, can he? Because he's sending out all the right signals about frugality and supporting the British economy in hard times by choosing this local holiday. And yet, almost all local people are grumbling. And the reaction is, oh, no, is he really coming here? Are you sure? You know, one bloke, almost the first pensioner I spoke to, said he can take a long walk off our very short pier. like that. So.
nice approach. It's a very different location to Tony Blair's choices, which included the Barbados villa owned by Sir Cliff Richard and also the BG Robin Gibbs's Florida mansion.
Yeah, you kind of think, well, Gordon's obviously attuned to the political weather and he knows that this is the only decision that really can be taken in these times. David Cameron's making a big thing about taking a week in Cornwall as well. But you also think that probably, given the sort of person that Gordon Brown is, this kind of holiday is closer to his heart. You know, he will almost certainly have a nice tucked away little holiday cottage and him and Sarah and his small children can enjoy a sort of quiet, traditional time. I mean, For all the spin, I mean, Gordon Brown isn't really very flash, is he? And one suspects that he isn't just taking this modest trip out of political expediency. He's probably doing it because he'd prefer to do that.
I'd love to see him with rolled up trousers and on the back of a donkey, but I don't think that's going to happen, is it?
You can sort of imagine him, can't you, with a spotted handkerchief on his head and so on. But you'd imagine security detail would have to clear the beach first. And even here, though, Gordon's not good. He's never going to be able to escape his work, is he? Because you can see Sizewell B looming down the coast, which is a nuclear power station, you know, a reminder of the sort of looming energy crisis in this country. And there's all sorts of other issues here that Brown will probably pick up on when he stays here, like the price of second homes and the fact that local families can't really afford homes here and that kind of thing. So that's the problem with holidaying in Britain, is all these sort of prime ministerial tasks facing him, he'll be reminded of them at everywhere he turns.
The Suffolk Resort, where you could be rubbing shoulders with Gordon Brown and his family. Well, it wasn't a book about the inner lives of rooks and jackdaws or the recreation of a challenging expedition through the Congo that got the judges' vote in the end. Announced last night, the winner of the 2008 Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction went to The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher by Kate Summerscale. Jack Witcher was the most celebrated detective of the 1860s, and the winner has walked off with £30,000. The Guardian's Lindsay Irvin met her.
I feel completely dazed and amazed, and I haven't taken it in yet, but no, it's incredible. It's been completely wonderful being on the shortlist for a couple of months, and I've been basking in that glory. It never occurred to me there would be anything to follow.
Could you just briefly retrace for us how you found the story and why you found it interesting initially?
I came across it in an old book, an anthology of Victorian crimes, and I initially was gripped by the family story, because the little boy who was murdered, it was clear that somebody within the family or the household, one of the servants, had murdered him, and lots of dark secrets about this Victorian family came out.
But it became a story as much about the murders as about the detective investigating them.
Yes. The thing that persuaded me that I could write something knew about the case was the figure of the detective. And when I realised that this was a formative case, not only in the development of detection as an idea in Victorian England, as a profession, but also detective fiction, it suddenly took on all these extra rich layers, and I became very intrigued by the figure of Detective Inspector Jack Witcher himself, whose career and life were sort of blighted by his involvement with this case.
Yes, I mean, that's the fascinating thing about this book, or one of the fascinating things about this book, is that it does appear initially to be quite a dusty corner of Victorian social history, but it actually opens up onto some extraordinarily urgent contemporary questions about the way we treat murders and the way that we sensationalise crime and so on.
I realised that it was one of the biggest cases in the sort of new crime reporting that was taking off. The newspaper, the press had massively expanded, so had crime reporting, and it made the facts of a mysterious and terrible crime available to much of the literate population. So everyone got involved and came up with their own theories and hypotheses, and the newspapers freely named people as suspects and murderers. And all that seemed to me the birth of something that we're still with today. And it was fascinating to see where it began and what it meant then compared to what it means now.
That's it from us for today. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth were the producers. My name's Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.